Question. Who played the rhythmic bones on Billy Murray's 1922 recording of I'll See You in CUBA?
Aristotle Figg.
Any boob would know.
And here are two who know everything about music recorded prior to 1925. Dr. Vincent Arbogast and Mr. Titus McFatridge. My name is Larry Thor, and we welcome you to The Record Collectors. Some people collect stamps, seashells, or old coins. Others collect paintings, butterflies, or match covers. With us tonight are two gentlemen who collect old records. They are Dr. Vincent Arbogast and Mr. Titus McFatridge. And to take them in alphabetical order, let's hear first from Dr. Arbogast. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Thor, and friends out there in Radio Land.
And Mrs. Tessie Dorblin in La Jolla.
Well, before we get to our records, gentlemen, I'd like to talk about what you two do. I mean in the fields of commerce as opposed to your hobby. And Dr. Arbogast, you're a breeder of giant frogs, right?
Mother and I have a frog farm at Costa Mesa.
Yes. Dr. Arbogast, are you a real doctor?
Let me answer your question with a question, Mr. Thorpe. Are frogs entitled to medical services?
If they're sick.
You would deny them medical service if they were well?
No, I didn't say that, Doctor. All I asked you was, are you a medical doctor?
No.
I see.
One day, several years ago, a mutinous assistant at the farm challenged one of my frog-feeding formulae. I told him, that formula or pack your duds.
An ultimatum.
Pack your duds. He simpered, you're the doctor.
That's how you became Dr. Vincent Arbogast.
Yes.
Mr. McFatridge, you, I believe, are engaged in the field of teratology, right?
Roger.
Roger?
Titus heard an aeronautist use it as a form of agreement.
Oh. Well, sir, what is teratology, Mr. McFatridge?
The science of creating monsters.
Monsters.
I made a dilly for a Christmas parade in Muncie, Indiana, for a department store.
What kind of monster was it, sir? Specifically, I mean.
Well, I took the body of a crocodile, the head of the bearded yak, and the wings of the condor. Beautiful. I felt that I had something here that would frighten any child.
Well, at a Christmas parade, is that what you wanted?
Yes, yes.
Did it work, sir?
No. There were no children to frighten. They had all fled in terror from the first exhibit in the parade, a monster five floats ahead.
What was that?
Well, it was a man-like thing stuffed into a flaming red suit with a raging white beard. As it lashed its reindeer, it waved ferociously in all directions, shouting threats at the crowd. The children left.
Well, now let's hear our first record, gentlemen, if we may.
Well, this selection is an example of the work of a rising young songwriter who, I prophesy, may give Victor Herbert a run for his money.
Uh-huh.
I refer to Irving Berlin. The tune of 1922 is a musical commentary on the effects of the Volstead Act.
You know, during that period, the increased use of stimulating beverages was in itself evidence that the American public was unaware of the existence of the Volstead Act.
But this song put them straight. Billy Murray, popular entertainer of the 20s, sings Irving Berlin's I'll See You in CUBA.
Not so far from here, there's a very lively atmosphere. Everybody's going there this year. And there's a reason. The season opened last July. Ever since the USA went dry, everybody's going there and I'm going too. I'm on my way to Cuba. That's where I'm going. Cuba, that's where I'll stay. Cuba, where wine is flowing, and where dark-eyed stellas light their fellas, panatellas. Cuba, where all is happy. Cuba, where all is gay. Why don't you plan a wonderful trip to Havana? Hop on a ship and I'll see you in C-U-B-A.
Now, Mr. McFatridge, do you have any special information about this record we just played?
Aristotle Figg was to have played the Rhythmic Bones on that record date.
Was to have, sir?
They wrote him out at the last minute.
Well, that's too bad.
Figg never wanted to play the Bones anyway. He was a bass drummist at heart, played in the village band back in the Midwest. The bandmaster hated his superior talent and was always trying to find a way to get rid of him.
Well, did he find a way?
Please. Aristotle Figg's son, Bonafide, dabbled in amateur chemistry. A wretched child. He also chewed bubble gum incessantly. At the Sunday school picnic, he turned up chewing and carrying some of his chemicals in a vacuum flask.
Yes.
He was drinking this mixture in between blowing gum bubbles and listening to the band.
The band was there.
Young Figg didn't know it, but the chemicals he had mixed and was sampling were in just the correct proportions to form helium gas. He blew one monstrous bubble.
What happened?
He took off. There he was, hovering aloft.
Well, did he just float aimlessly around up there?
No. They shot him down over the bandstand. The minister, fortunately, had his slingshot with him.
Was the boy hurt?
No. He landed on his father's bass drum.
That's pretty lucky.
On the contrary, Mr. Thor, the elder Figg was counting out an 18-bar rest, 3 bars before F in the Poet and Peasant, when boom-ti-boom landed his son. For that interruption, the bandmaster fired Aristotle Figg, who then developed this talent for the rhythmic bones and entered the popular music field.
This next record is Dr. Arbogast's.
This record, Mr. Thor, dates back 33 years to 1919. It features one of the most popular feminine singers of that blessed era, the incomparable Miss Nora Bayes.
Nora Bayes.
Very great artist, gentlemen.
Many movies in that early day had a wicked woman of the world who had designs upon the noble hero. These women were called vamps. Among them were Theda Bara,
Jetta Goodall.
Never belabor a point, Mr. McFatridge. This record is entitled The Village Vamp, and it shows the effect of this type of movie upon a simple country girl. The Village Vamp, as sung by Nora Bates.
Have you heard about Miss Sally Green? Sally Green, Sally Green. Back home she was called the village queen. Sally Green was queen. She took one trip to the city, came back home, oh, what a pity. Now the folks call her the village vamp. She's a vamp. She wears high-heeled shoes and fancy hose. She's a vamp. She's a vamp. Paints her face and powders up her nose. She's a vamp. She's a vamp. Folks all say down in the valley, look what Broadway did to Sally. Everywhere she goes, the roofs all say, hey, there goes the vamp. There goes the vamp.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yes, Dr. Arbogast. By the way, how long have you been collecting records?
Approximately 30 years, 4 months.
And how many do you have, sir, approximately?
Really, I wouldn't venture to say. I measure my collection by values far removed from consideration of mere number.
Well, Dr. Arbogast, how do you measure the value of the records in your collection?
I realized, Mr. Thor, that everybody was collecting the records of artists who were so good that the public didn't appreciate them. But nobody was saving the records of the singers and musicians who were popular in their day. I determined to remedy that deplorable situation.
How?
Whereas the average collector selects records featuring excellent artistry and musicianship, I set out to acquire records that once sold by the millions, the records the general public paid its money for. There is seldom any conflict.
I see. Now, let's hear from our other collector, Mr. Titus McFatridge.
The records in my collection, if laid side by side, would cover two-thirds of the space of a basketball court.
That's very interesting, sir. How many records does that make?
I really haven't the slightest idea. At one time, I resided at the YMCA in Muncie, Indiana.
Yes?
I needed to catalog and sort out my records. Since my room was small, the secretary of the YMCA, Stanley Proctor by name, kindly gave me permission to spread out my records in the gym while the fellows on the team were in the showers. I noted that my records took up two-thirds of the basketball court. Now, those wishing to know exactly the number of records might write to the Muncie, Indiana YMCA for dimensions of the court, and by the aid of simple arithmetic, compute the number of records I had at that time. Stanley Proctor, however, is no longer there. He was, I believe, transferred to Terre Haute in 1932.
Well, it doesn't matter, Mr. McFadden.
Fort Wayne, not Terre Haute. Pardon me.
Thank you, sir. Now, suppose we hear one of the records you gentlemen have rescued from oblivion, Dr. Arbogast.
It is the hit tune of 1923, Toot, Toot, Tootsie. It is sung by that very popular duo of vaudeville and records, Murray and Smalley.
Oh, yes, they were great favorites. And this record was made in 1923, you see.
Yes, yes, made by the time-proven acoustical method of recording, the natural method that was so heartlessly abandoned when the present maniacal craze for electrical recording corrupted the record industry.
Well, suppose we hear the record and let the listeners decide for themselves.
I accept that challenge with confidence and éclat, Mr. Thor. An acoustical record made circa 1923 by Billy Murray and Eddie Smalley. Toot, toot, tootsie. And oh, please note the realistic train whistle interpolated into the rendition.
Yesterday I heard a lover sigh.
A lover sigh.
Goodbye.
Said goodbye.
Oh me, oh my.
Oh me, oh my, oh.
7 times he got aboard his train.
Aboard his train.
And 7 times he hurried back to kiss his love again and tell her to see goodbye.
They mentioned a letter in that record. Now, gentlemen, that's timely. It's time to listen to the listener. And the letterbox is open. I have one here from the South, Tampa, Florida, a Mrs. J.R.W. She wants to know if you could give her the title of an old, old tune recorded in 1914 on the Dulcet label.
Nothing is ever recorded on the label, Mr. Thor.
I didn't make myself clear, sir. Anyway, it was a lady singing the melody with what was then a unique accompaniment, a pipe organ and a banjo.
Well, that makes it easy to place this song mentioned by our friend out there in Radio Land. I know of only one such record ever made.
That's right, Vincent. And to answer the lady's question, the title of the melody was Out of a City of 10,000 People, Why Did You Pick on Me?
Good for you.
Mr. McFatridge, do you have some special background information on that record, please?
Pesag Gaskell, I think, played clarinet on that one. Do you mind Pesag, Vincent?
Oh, my, yes, I mind Pesag Gaskell well. Good clarinetist. He was a channel swimmer, too.
Channel swimmer?
The best.
There was a champion. Pesag never used grease. He used to flex his little muscles and say proudly, "What's good enough for the blue whale is good enough for me."
Which way did he swim the channel? East-west or west-east?
You say the channel, Mr. Thor.
Yes, the English channel.
It's infuriating to assume there is only one channel to swim.
And even more infuriating to limit it to two opposite directions. I knew a very good bias swimmer once who could swim only diagonal.
Well, that's it, gentlemen. Our time is up.
He was once compared favorably with the Lemming.
Well, I know you'll have more of these wonderful records for us next week, and that you'll be here to explain them to us. Meanwhile, we'd better say goodnight to our listeners.
Good night, friends out there in Radio Land.
And Mrs. Carrie Mumaw in the Needles Public Library.
Who played the whalebone lute on the 1922 recording of Yes, We Have No Bananas? Is the acoustical recording method superior to the electrical method? These and other incredible questions will be answered next week as we bring you Arbogast and McFatridge, the Record Collectors. This is Larry Thor speaking. This program came to you transcribed from Hollywood. This is the CBS Radio Network.